I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd take a little tour of U.S. foreign policy today. The president just returned from a trip to Asia. Now, the biggest problem for the U.S. right now in Asia is China. What is going on with our negotiations with China and what the U.S. is trying to accomplish there, Jim?
Well, the problem we have here is basically connected with that piece we spoke about, you know, was it last time, about the Empire Strike Back, about Russia and China trying to rebuild their empires. Now, unlike the Cold War, where we were obviously in conflict with Russia and to a lesser extent with China, this time the items, the countries, the areas that are being basically fought over diplomatically are much closer to Russia and China than they are to the United States. You know, it was one thing to for the United States and Russia to get involved in issues in the Middle East or Africa, you know, or South America, what have you. But it's very different if it's in the, you know, one side's backyard. And what some diplomatic historians are pointing out, that this puts the United States at a severe disadvantage. You know, it's sort of like what went on in the United States in the early 19th century when the Monroe Doctrine was established, when the United States basically felt strong enough, sound familiar, to tell the European nations, stay out of the this hemisphere. In other words, don't get involved unless you have our permission. Sound familiar? And this is something that we actually recognized before. The Cold War was based on the idea that we're not going to confront Russia, or China for that matter, in their own backyard. And this was especially common with Russia, where we basically, you know, let them have Eastern Europe. I mean, this is Mr. Keenan's famous, you know, advice, which was followed, to contain the Soviet Union, not to basically try and fight them and possibly start a nuclear war. So when the uprisings occurred in Germany in 53, in the Czechoslovakia in 68, in Hungary in 56, in Poland in the 1980, we didn't do anything. I mean, we yelled and screamed and, you know, and did the usual press release routine, but we didn't actually do anything, which a lot of Americans were calling for, to do something. The idea being that if we did something, it would start a potentially escalating confrontation with Russia. And after what happened in Cuba, which again in 61, which was a Monroe Doctrine, you know, the test by the Soviets, they backed off. And apparently, whether it was, this has not yet come out, whether there was a an official, unofficial, secret, you know, understanding that if they observed the Monroe Doctrine, we would observe the, you know, the Russian Empire Doctrine. That is what we did. Now, what's happening now is that a lot of these new countries that were formed when the Soviet Union fell apart in 91, and half the population of the Soviet Union went off to form 14 new countries, many of them countries that had existed before but had been taken over by Russia in the previous two centuries. Many of those countries started looking for allies against Russia. In other words, they knew from the start that, you know, the Russians were going to come back. And this is what has actually been happening, first with Georgia in 2008, and now with Ukraine, and there are many other areas. And the question is, do we get that involved so close to, you know, the Russia itself? Now, Poland and the Baltic states managed to join NATO. So we are by treaty obliged. There's also a lot of, how should I put it, historic guilt about Poland. They were abandoned. Actually, they were abandoned in 39 at the start of, you know, World War II, but they were actually abandoned several times, you know, before that. I mean, they were partitioned in the 18th century, actually several times. and the Poland literally disappeared for a long time. And the Poles worked that, you know, they worked that guilt. They said, look, you guys have cut us loose. You know, we're basically a true European country, meaning we're a Catholic country, not an Orthodox Christian country. And we've always looked west, not east. And so there's a certain amount of willingness on the part of, reluctant willingness, I call it, on the part of European countries to actually back up Poland this time. Now, it's easier this time around because there's a direct land connection. Poland borders, other NATO allies, also the Baltic states, although they're much more exposed, they're much smaller. But again, they were abandoned as well, you know, in about the same time the Poles were before World War II. And they identify very strongly with the West, not with Russia. So there's an area where it might indeed, you know, come to another nuclear showdown. The Russians have shown some interest in making a play for the Baltic states. Poland, even the Russians understand, Poland might be, you know, a reconquest too far. That remains to be seen. But right now they feel, and they've always said outright, that Ukraine and Belarus have been and should still be parts of Russia. And they're trying to carry that out. Now, it's up in the air how that's going to work out, because Russia is making an enormous gamble here. They are no longer the Soviet Union. They are much more dependent on trade with the West, if only to sell their oil. They have a huge problem with corruption, which actually they had during the Tsarist days, but that's another story. And if they get the kind of sanctions put on them that have been put on, say Iran, they are in big trouble. Because the economy has made progress since the breakup of the Soviet Union, in part because a market economy, came into being, and that's much more efficient. But secondly, because while the new Russia lost half its population, it kept most of its natural resources, a lot of oil and natural gas and other things, which in effect, made the average Russian a lot wealthier on paper initially and eventually, actually. They can remember 20 years ago, they had a lot less money, a lot fewer things they could buy, and that's changed dramatically. So there's a lot of popular and emotional support for what Putin is trying to do and rebuild the empire. And it all comes down to how much does the West, or in this case the United States, want to risk another nuclear confrontation to stop what are basically, illegal conquests. I mean, the UN forbids it. It's basically a violation of international law. It's naked aggression. But if nobody stops it, it happens, and you just got to live with it.
So, Austin, your comments on President Obama's recent tour to the Asian area.
Are you referring to in part to that column I wrote on Japan's defense concerns in Asia, Dan?
Yes, and the United and how the United States is playing into all that.
Well, this is a complicated, extremely complicated issue, and I wrote a little bit about President Obama, but what I tried to do in that column was show the line of Japanese, evolution of it, but the Japanese concerns with China's growing power and also the emerging threat. And when I'm saying emerging threat, I'm talking about the 1980s of North Korea's ballistic missiles and its nascent nuclear weapons program. The Japanese were very aware that Deng Xiaoping's four modernizations, which Deng Xiaoping would also say were instituted in part by Zhou Enlai, who was the Mao's long-term advisor, they saw that what those effects were on China, and one of the modernizations was the military modernization. But coming along with the Chinese, you know, that was a Chinese turning its economy around, so it had the money to buy and build modern weapons. And here's why I say this is – I want to start in the late 80s is because that's when the Japanese made a decision, Dan, to build the what is called the Congo-class guided missile destroyer. And as Jim's written about the Congo-class, it's an Aegis destroyer, and it's really a large destroyer, size of a World War II cruiser. It so are Arleigh Burke destroyers that the United States deploys. But it was the Japanese made the decision in the late 80s to build a Congo class, and Dan, part and parcel of that was not only having the Aegis air defense system, was the ability to grow Congo class so that it could support anti-ballistic missiles, what is now a standard 3, or various some of the advanced standard 2s that had some ABM capability. Now, where this factors in to this goes now back to the end of World War II and the Constitution that the Allies, primarily the United States in occupation, imposed on Japan relative to Japan's military forces. Japan was not allowed a navy. It was allowed a naval self-defense force. It wasn't allowed an army. It was allowed a ground self-defense force, an air self-defense force, and the like. And actually, those were an evolution of what was in the late 40s, early 50s, a more or less a local constabulary force and a patrol boat, Coast Guard type force. Japan, in other words, was constitutionally forbidden from building large-scale military forces and having offensive military forces. Well, that's been changing for 30 or 40 years in part, and I just use that Congo class as an example of where you've moved to and say, hey, that's still a quote-unquote defensive system, except it's so easy, you start to, you know, to opaque or foggy situation where that it, you can easily arm them with offensive weapons. And the Japanese also looking at the threat posed by North Korea, and this is several groups within in Japan, said, look, if North Korea is this threat, we're going to have an offensive capability, because the best place to stop that ballistic missile would be to hit it on a pad. Now, that's an offensive strike. And the Japanese, having been the blight, military blight of Asia, were distrusted by all the other Asian countries. However, times change, and the Japanese began looking for, you know, saying, hey, we want an offensive capability. This is 20 years ago. So now that moves forward to now. Prime Minister Abe has been saying Japan needs an offensive capability. There is a movement on to change the Constitution. That's probably going to happen. Read the Japanese press. Some people say 6 weeks. I doubt that. Others 6 months. But sometime it's going to change because of the way the Japanese people now, and I think correctly, perceive the threats to their territory and interests in East Asia. The Senkaku Diao Island dispute with the Chinese. As Jim's written about this, the Japanese are developing an improved not just maritime patrol and maritime defense, but amphibious capabilities, Japanese naval infantry, Japanese Marines to protect some of their outlying islands. I'm talking about it with a ground presence as well as with naval forces. Now, to some degree, this is part and parcel of a so-called Asia pivot by the United States, as touted by the Obama administration. Obama spent some time in President Obama spent some time in the Philippines. We've covered on Strategy Page long before the mainstream media did the issues in the South China Sea, the Spratlys, Mischief Atoll, and Shoals, and many of the other disputed maritime boundaries in the South China Sea. We've also covered some of the complicated politics that exist between Taiwan, China, and Japan, and the Philippines, and Malaysia, and Vietnam. I don't include Vietnam in that because Vietnam lost part of the Spratlys to China. Vietnam has no real naval capabilities. And the other thing is South Korea, when in China, and we discussed this in a strategy talk a few months ago, when China imposed its new air defense zone, part of that new zone cut over boundary that South Korea has long claimed as South Korean maritime South Korean territory. It's actually some rocks on that break the surface of the sea, but it's in some very rich fishing grounds. So there's an economic component to it. It's a dangerous place. These are old territorial claims on the Chinese part. The Koreans have been claimed, now we're back and we're not going to be overrun either by the Japanese. I'm talking about South Korea, either by the Japanese or the Chinese. But the Japanese perceptions and I would say South Korean perceptions of China and, of course, North Korea, the roots of those are 30 or 40 years old. It's just that China is now, as Jim has written extensively, muscle flexing, and Japan is responding to it. Dan, how dangerous is it? I've said I don't think it's likely that China and Japan will go to war over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands, but this relates back to what Jim was just talking about Crimea and Ukraine, and said rather bluntly, if somebody thinks they can get away with it unless somebody stops them, they're going to try it. And the annexation, it wasn't just taking Ukraine, but on March 18th, Putin's government annexed Crimea. We just took it. Now we got it. And that's... It is extremely popular in Russia, the return of Crimea. A Chinese government in Beijing facing rampant charges of corruption throughout the country. And, they've had this, we've covered this, the some of the anti-corruption purges that the Beijing runs occasionally. But they have a population that disgruntled, if not angry, with their own government. How do you turn that around? Well, you take something from the old enemy, and the Chinese have a lot of reasons to hate the Japanese, but you revive some of that old hate, and you take something from them, maybe those islands. And that certainly has a galvanizing effect on the domestic politics, and suddenly you may be unpopular and disliked, but you did something that appeals emotionally to the a huge number of, I'd say, the vast majority of Chinese citizens. So there, it fits into a domestic political calculus. Just like what Putin did, and if the Russians can do it, why can't we? Thing is, though, is the Japanese are saying we're going to fight, and the Japanese have a much, much better have some outstanding defensive capabilities, and fairly soon, as I said in that column, and I'll wind it up with this, they're going to have some offensive capabilities which ought to have a deterrence effect.
Jim, we haven't heard a lot about Syria and the Middle East recently with everything happening in the Ukraine. How is Americans' foreign policy going there?
Well, Syria or anything in the Arab world is a major problem. I mean, you got to remember the Turks, who controlled most of the Middle East, most of the Arab countries for centuries, they had a saying, which they still refer to, is do not involve yourself with the affairs of the Arabs. In other words, they were saying it's like herding cats down there. And you can see that, you know, in the Arab world, I mean, they have tremendous problems with, you know, governing themselves, with fostering education, economic progress. You know, they just have a minuscule amount of, you know, economic activity and intellectual activity, like, you know, books published, books translated, and what have you. It's minuscule compared to, say, Europe or even Israel, which is extremely embarrassing. What it comes down to in Syria is what we learned in Libya. The Islamic radicalism, or Islamic terrorists, as it usually represents itself, is very popular in the Arab countries specifically, and in Muslim countries in general, but that's because they're aping the Arabs, who always proclaim themselves as the sons of Muhammad. You know, the Quran is written in Arabic, and if you really want to be at the top of the holier-than-thou heap, you should learn it in Arabic, even if you don't understand Arabic. So you have this cultural mishmash, which basically has the Arab populations, a lot of them, not the majority necessarily, but a large minority, back Islamic radicalism and the idea that Islam is under attack, which it really isn't. I mean, Islam is on the attack, and it always has been. I mean, that's the problem. That's part of they're the one religion that has offensive operations as their primary mode. They don't like to admit that. I mean, they have this whole effort to rebrand themselves as the religion of peace. Well, that's never been the case. I mean, just look at the numbers. You know, the amount of religious violence going on in the world, and it's nothing new. It's been going on for centuries. You know, the Arabs, for example, portray the Crusades as an act of aggression against the Muslim Islamic regions. Well, that's not true. The main reason the Crusades were launched was because the oppression of Christians in the Arab ruled holy cities, you know, in what is, you know, the Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and what have you. And, of course, it then turned into a land grab because this is the medieval period when, you know, nothing is done for, the afterlife. If there's money to be made, you make it. And, you know, the Crusaders stayed around for several centuries before eventually getting pushed out. But there were still Christians there. And they've been oppressed ever since, and their numbers continue to decline, especially in the last century. You have Saudi Arabia, you know, the only country in the world where no other religion except Islam is allowed. You cannot, you know, have a non-Islamic house of worship. There are no Christian churches allowed. You can pray, but you got to do it in private. No public expressions of any religion but Islam. Now that is unheard of outside of a place like Saudi Arabia and a few other, you know, Islamic states. But this is what we have to deal with because a major component of these uprisings, like in Libya and in Syria, are what we call Islamic terrorists, groups that have openly said, once we conquer either Libya, which they've already done, and Syria, then we use that as a base to launch more attacks on the West. Or on other, you know, states that are not yet run by Islamic radicals, which means almost all of the countries in the Arab world, because the majority of Arabs do not want to be ruled by a religious dictatorship. It's been tried before, and again, most Muslims don't like to admit this. They don't like to admit their own written, verified history that, you know, the caliphate, you know, the unified Islamic multi-state, a regional state, only existed for a few hundred years. It did not work. It fell apart because of national ethnic differences, and the efforts to rebuild it have failed for over 1,000 years. That is not something that you can admit or get behind in the Islamic world, because it is basically a fundamental belief that, yes, this the caliphate is good and we should back it. But as a practical matter, you can't. And it's the same thing with, you know, Islamic radicals. Now, a lot of the apologists for Islam say, well, they're not real Muslims. Well, of course, that's what the radicals say about any Muslim who doesn't back them. You know, the trouble is there's no Islamic pope. You know, there is no, you know, central authority you can go to. And that's part of the problem. There's just chaos. To give you a practical example, there's never been an agreed upon in the Arab world system for pronouncing, transliterating Arabic into other languages. That's why, you know, when you try and use Google to find Gaddafi, you find that there's, what, 50 or 60 accepted, shall we say, translations of his name, you know, into English. And it's the same in other languages, because the Chinese solved that problem very easily. You know, after the communists took over, they said, all right, we're going to, yeah, anybody who disagrees gets shot. You know, but they did it. But it happened in the West, where there was, you know, agreements on the use of the Latin alphabet and what have you. You haven't got any of that kind of unity in the Arab world. And this is a big problem for anybody who's trying to deal with disputes within the Arab world. Libya, we did get behind the rebels. They won. But now that the Islamic radicals have a strong representation in the government, and for a practical matter, you have basically sanctuaries for Islamic terrorist groups. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, that's how Western counterterrorism groups, you know, look at it, because that is the reality on the ground. And that's why Western countries, you know, in their hearts say, you know, we should help the Syrian rebels. They're being oppressed by Assad, who's a typical, you know, Arab dictator. But at the same time, they know intellectually, you got to listen to yourself, so to speak, say, well, if we do this, it's going to be more grief for the West. We're simply going to create another base for Islamic terrorists, you know, in the region. So we're screwed no matter what we do. I mean, it's like, you know, during the 80s now, it's convenient for the media and a lot of people to forget just who backed who during then. You know, some people like to say, well, we backed Saddam. We never backed Saddam. I mean, I was there. I was reading the newspapers, and the American officials were saying, you know, we hope both sides lose. I mean, the only reason we backed, you know, gave any support, and usually, you know, satellite photos to Saddam Hussein, he bought most of his weapons from, you know, places like North Korea and Russia, not the United States. Was because Saudi Arabia didn't want Iran to get a running start, you know, into Iraq and then keep coming south and overrun the Arabian Peninsula. And the United States and Saudi Arabia agreed that that would not be a good thing. So we hoped that they would just, you know, battle themselves into a stalemate, and it would finally – and that's exactly what happened. So in a morbid sense – you know, the preferred outcome for the West was that what actually happened. They both, Iran finally agreed to stop. You know, the war never officially ended. They just, you know, there was a stalemate. There was nobody was getting anywhere. So they basically said, all right, the fighting's over. That is something that's typical of what goes on in that part of the world, which is what makes it a very difficult place to practice any kind of optimistic diplomacy. Because too many of the situations you find yourselves in are what can basically accurately be described as no-win situations. No matter what we do, you know, there's going to be blowback. And while people will stand up on an electronic outlet they can get into and say, well, the United States is wrong. Nobody can come up has yet to come up with a strategy that would actually work. They just say, well, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Well, that's fine. You know, there's a lot of wrong in the world. But what is the solution? What is going to work? What is right? You know, asking Israel to, you know, make all sorts of concessions and while ignoring all the concessions they already have made, which have blown up in their faces, you know, just is stupid. The Israelis are there. They're a democracy. They're not going to commit suicide. You know, they still have living memory and living survivors of, you know, the Holocaust, you know, the mass murder by the Germans in World War II. And even before World War II, there were several, you know, massacres of Jews by Arabs, you know, in what is now Israel. So they have no illusions about, you know, what can work and what cannot work, which is why they consider the example, the current American diplomatic effort to coerce, as it were, a peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis as absurd. They just can't understand what are the Americans thinking. I mean, what logic are they using? It makes absolutely no sense right there. I mean, if you can read, which many Israelis can do, you know, Arabic, and they've listened to Palestinian media, these people, you know, Palestinians have no intention of ever really making peace with Israel. They just want to make political deals where they can get a tactical advantage and keep attacking. The current deal, recent one between Hamas and Fatah, where they basically reunited the Palestinians, the way Fatah puts it is, we are admitting that we're terrorists and we are united with Hamas, which has always been an admittedly terrorist organization whose main goal is to literally destroy Israel and to run all Jews out of the region. I mean, they make no bones about that. They say that's what they're going to do. And one reason why they're under all sorts of, you know, international terrorist lists and all sorts of sanctions is because they will not change that. You know, credit to them. They're being honest. Because many other groups in the Middle East, they say that, hey, yeah, we'll make peace. But again, it's usually the propaganda in Arabic, not in English or French or whatever, you know, says we'll make peace. But in Arabic, they say we got to kill the bastards. And so how do you formulate a diplomacy, a diplomatic strategy under those conditions? That is the question. Nobody has an answer.
Austin, your comments?
I think Jim has done a really good job of hitting the essential problem. And that's what's let me add this, Dan, particularly in light of Secretary of State Kerry's comments that have, you know, apparently he did use the term saying that Israel, if it didn't work out a two-state solution with the Palestinians, was on its way to being an apartheid state. Now, he's backtracked that, and he was supposedly saying it in a private forum, but, you know, said it, and there were reporters there as well. You know, that's that not only is inaccurate, very inaccurate on it. It also shows a lack of sense about diplomacy, and part of a key to successful diplomacy is creating trust on both sides of when you're a diplomat trying to solve an extensive problem. And Kerry exemplifies, at least in my view, the diplomat who wants an agreement just to get an agreement. As Jim has shown, that what Jim just described is a situation where the parties are not ripe for a long-term agreement, and he's largely focusing on the failures of the Palestinians and the the most of the Arab world in general, and it's unfortunately this is one of those long-term struggles that is, it's not going to be solved with a bold stroke that results in a Nobel Peace Prize. Many of the reasons that Jim just laid out.
Jim, What about specifically Iran? What is happening there? We've continued to put sanctions on Iran. Are they continuing to be effective? Where is Iran towards developing its nuclear capability?
All right, the primary thing to remember about Iran is they are not Arabs. The Iranians have been much more organized, much more rational, much more successful. And they've been the dominant, they have been the regional superpower for literally thousands of years. For that reason, the Arabs are very afraid of them, because they know if there's anybody in their immediate neighborhood who could, if given half a chance, create another empire, it's the Iranians. The Iranians have made this interim deal where they're supposed to negotiate a long-term deal. Again, you've got to look at what people, what nations are saying internally to their own people, not what they say, you know, diplomatically. The Iranians are saying, you know, we won a great victory by getting this temporary deal and getting maybe, you know, half a billion or a couple billion dollars worth of assets released, cash, which they can always use because their oil exports have been cut in half in the last year because of the latest sanctions. But it's they're telling their own people that this is the first phase of us basically overturning all these sanctions and getting oil production back to its full state, et cetera, et cetera. In the West, we're saying just the opposite. They have to basically give up their nukes and their ballistic missiles, which the Iranians have no interest in doing. That those weapons are very popular with the average Iranian, again, because they see themselves like the Russians as, you know, the natural operators of an empire, and that empire, the Iranian empire, has been in decline for several centuries now for various reasons. Again, your average Iranian, forget logic, you know, Iran needs respect, is basic, the basic attitude, which is what you're getting with China and with Russia. But at the moment, they are suffering. They still have half of their oil piling up or not being pumped because they can't sell it to anybody. And the United States has said, along with the Western countries, is that we're not going to back off on this. If they do not make some serious deal with us about their nukes, which means, you know, the allowing open inspections and, you know, agreeing to a whole bunch of technical things which we've written about, no need getting into again, to make it fairly certain that they are not still developing a nuclear bomb, then, you know, the sanctions are going to remain and, you know, there's talk of intensifying it. So right now, it's still a stalemate, but the Iranians have won a minor victory in stopping the process of increasing the sanctions. In other words, cutting their oil exports down to, say, you know, a third of what they used to be. And that causes real pain in Iran. Iran is basically a religious dictatorship, has been for almost three decades, and the dictatorship is corrupt. They have economic problems because of that. They need that oil money. I mean, like Gaddafi did, he basically used the oil money to buy off, you know, opponents and basically delay revolution for, you know, over 30 years. The Shia clergy who are running Iran are doing the same thing. And of course, they're running out of money, which means they're running out of the means to put out this growing fire, this conflagration that could burn them up. They're also spending a lot of money in Syria because Syria is part of their brand strategy of basically making Iran, not Saudi Arabia, the head of a united Islamic world. Again, which is stupid. Again, if you look, take the man from Mars position and just look at, you know, the history of Islam, you know, that's tilting at windmills. It's just, you know, a fool's errand. But you've got the even the Saudis don't try and are not talking about reestablishing the caliphate. They are simply the guardians of the most holy shrines in Islam, and they have their oil, and that's as far as their ambitions go. I mean, that's all they say internally. They have no, you know, secret agenda. The Iranians, on the other hand, are fighting a global war. And Syria was one of their victories, as was Hezbollah, which controls most of southern, you know, Lebanon. And they're pouring billions and billions, you know, dollars, you know, over $1 billion a month into that. It's money they cannot afford. A lot of Iranians are openly critical of that because, hey, we got needs here, and you're spending all this money on you know, mercenaries and goods to prop up this Assad, you know, dictatorship. What about us? So that's a problem. So that so far is a victory. But again, it's mainly because we're not dealing with Arabs.
Austin, I'm going to take a different track here to wrap things up because we haven't touched on it yet, and I know you're our expert on this, but what is happening with American foreign policy in with the African countries at this point?
Oh, Dan, we ought to save that for this has actually been a long and involved strategy talk. Of course, it was a broad subject. There's a lot going on, and then there's a lot not going on. And if we, you know, if we start off on it, I would suggest that would be a topic for another program. We just wouldn't do justice to the actions going on in southern Sudan or inactions. We wouldn't do justice to Darfur, and we wouldn't do justice to some of the other ongoing. Well, I was going to say crises, but they're really just tragedies as well, you know, ongoing tragedies. Let's defer that one. All right?
All right. So basically we could say it's very complicated in Africa.
Extremely complicated. And it
but more successful in dealing with the Arabs. I'll give it that. There's no doubt that it's complicated. But no, seriously, I mean, I'm not being anti-Arab here. I'm simply, you know, again, you look at the history of these different areas. Africa's long been a problem because of the tribalism, but you've also got that in the Arab world.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the Arabs have these, well, as one Israeli diplomat put it, you know, the Arabs never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. They just, you know, embrace failure. Whereas in the African states, they have made substantial changes. You know, they were all into socialism, and you know, backing dictatorial governments after most of them ceased being colonies in the 1960s and 70s. But after 20 years, there was a general realization that, you know, this isn't working. And suddenly you had democracies all over the place, and there was progress. A lot of African countries have actually made substantial progress, again, because Africa is a very complex place. You know, they have over 500 different cultures. I mean, you have some groups of tribes that have a culture which is very ambitious, very adaptive, willing to learn. They educate their kids to a much higher level than a lot of the surrounding groups and what have you, and they make a difference. So at least in Africa, there's more hope than there is in the Arab world. But Austin's right. If you want to get into the details, that's going to take a whole other separate. You know,
absolutely.
Right. And I had lost track of time, to tell you the truth, guys. So I see that we're at our time limit. So we'll wrap it up with that. And we'll talk to you next time.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.